This is Radio Freethinker, episode 81.
With Rogers On Demand, you can watch the TV you want, whenever you want.
And we're on Radio Freethinker here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We wanted to play
the Pope song by Tim Mitchin, something I thought was really appropriate for this, and I've even pre-tested it on some test audiences, but apparently some people thought that it might have just been slightly inappropriate for daytime radio. I don't know. It mentioned something about fluffing or something like that, and quite a bit. And then we, of course, tried to at the last minute come up with an alternative song, but found out that YouTube has commercials. And so instead of playing you the Rogers commercial, we just thought we'd skip the intro song for now and maybe play it as an extra song or something.
Sure, why not? Well, welcome to Radio Freethinker, everybody, the radio show program that promotes skepticism and critical thinking. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver.
This is Don, your philosopher political science guy.
This is Chloe, member of UBC Freethinkers.
This is Daniel, president of the UBC Freethinkers and student here at UBC.
Well, everybody, how was your week?
Wonderful. Thank you for asking.
Oh, you're welcome.
My week was pretty good. I learned that I'm less likely to get a heart attack than I thought I was last week.
That's exciting. Why is that?
Well, apparently there's a study that was released recently that says the seasonal flu shot is linked to reduced heart rate. In fact, if you read today's Metro, you will see that there's a small article on it, although the percentages aren't quite the same. Apparently, in the past, there was thought to be a correlation between myocardial infarction, heart attack, and respiratory infections. So they thought, well, what stops a respiratory infections? Influenza and streptococcus vaccines, or, you know, cause your seasonal type flus, and let's see if there's any correlation. So what they did is in the United Kingdom, they took some 40-year-olds who had their first heart attack between November 1st and 31, tried to match them up for risk factors and use a bunch of other statistical things, and came out with the fact that you would be about 19% less likely to get a heart attack if you had the influenza vaccine. Sadly enough, the streptococcus or pneumonia vaccine didn't help you at all for a heart attack. Of course, it does help you against the thing. It was actually quite a good study, really, because it was quite a large number. There were about 79,000 people involved. Out of those, about 15,000 had heart attacks, and 62,000 were used sort of as control. Out of those two subgroups, about 50% of them had the vaccination, and the other half didn't. So, by and large, it was a reasonably good study. It was one study, though, so there needs to be follow-up, of course, in this. And as I say, it seems that there is a positive association to getting the seasonal influenza flu vaccine. More evidence to say get your shots.
So even if you're one of those people who uses the argument, well, I never actually get the flu, to not get the seasonal flu vaccine, well, you might as well now. It might keep you from getting a heart attack.
Exactly. You know, maybe we can, that'll add some numbers we should add to Jenny McCarthy's death clock, because not only will we have people dying from influenza, but now we'll have them also dying from heart attack.
I think before we do that, we should wait for a little more research, but
I suppose this was just one study.
Yes. But the point of this study, of course, was to check. Actually, oddly enough, it was a negative study in the one sense, because their original background, the original purpose of this was to show, is there a relationship between respiratory infection and heart attacks? That was what they thought. And they thought, well, we'll go about this sort of in a negative way by saying those people who are less likely to get a respiratory infection because they were vaccinated should correspondingly be less likely to a heart attack. So they were sort of proving a negative correlation in that sense.
Interesting.
Yes, science does its thing really well.
Very good. Well, what else is science doing?
Making super potatoes.
That sounds amazing.
Yes. Basically, some researchers in India combined one gene. This is just one modified gene that does all of this. From an amaranth plant, which I'm not sure how many people know much about it, but it's a grain used often in South America and is starting to move into other places because it's high in protein. They mix that with the regular potato, many different versions of the potato that we have, and found one that had up to 60% more protein in it, which by itself is amazing. Like, imagine every time you eat a potato, you're getting 60% extra protein. That's great, especially for people in developing countries who are often protein deficient, yet eat a lot of potatoes.
Now, let me reflect the mood of the local papers lately and go, oh, my God, it's Franken potato. I don't know if anyone's been listening, but there's been a big thing about Frankenfish and how they added a gene from a Chinook to a coho salmon, I think that's the way it works, to make it grow like 60 times faster than it normally would. And everyone's going, it's been approved by the United States FDA to sell to people, and they're going, oh no, it's the end of life as we know it. Does this potato, do you think, have that similar kind of future, or do you think starving people in India are willing to say, I'm willing to risk it?
I looked at some of the sort of anti-GM food blogs, anti-GM food organizations, and I couldn't find many actually mentioning this. It seems to be kind of blanket good news that it's hard for them to bring up and still argue their general point. Basically, the potato hasn't changed much. It's just one extra gene in it. Apparently, it makes it easier to cook as well. And it has 15 to 20% higher yields, crop yields. So on the same amount of land, you can get 15 to 20% more potatoes. It's like all around good news. There's almost nothing bad about this. And only one changed gene. So,
and let's not forget, when you fry it, it smells like bacon.
No, sadly. No? They haven't got that one in there yet.
So they changed one gene? They didn't add anything?
They added one gene.
Oh, okay.
But compared to some genetically modified food, that's a pretty small change.
Sure.
It's also a nice change in the sense that it's not actually adding an animal gene to a vegetable product, which I know can cause issues in terms of allergies and that kind of thing.
Exactly. It's a relatively simple one. It's taking a gene from something commonly eaten already and edible and putting it in there.
Although, and I'm just going to play advocate here, you know, my clairvoyance. You said that this amaranth gene comes from a grain?
Amaranth. For anyone who's allergic to wheat flour like myself, you're very familiar with amaranth flour.
Which was exactly, because, I mean, isn't one of the alternatives for people who are allergic to wheat flour, potato flour, and rice flour? And, well, I don't know about rice flour, because rice is a grain too, right?
No, rice is okay.
Okay. So I predict that that's going to be the next hurdle it's going to have to in the public sphere, is that, oh no, you're going to infect potatoes now with this gene, which is going to make all potatoes unaccessible to people who happen to be allergic to flour.
Well, this particular type of flour is okay for people who are allergic to wheat or to gluten, which is a protein in wheat flour and in spelt and in something else, but not amaranth. The problem that might arise is that amaranth allergies could go up. I mean, I think one of the reasons that soy and wheat allergies, one theory that's out there, have gone up in the last 10 years is because we eat so much of it. Our body gets saturated. So that's a possibility, but I don't see this being a problem for people who are just allergic to flour, period.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's only one gene from amaranth, so it might not actually affect people who are allergic to that.
Right.
What do the Irish say?
Pardon?
What do the Irish say? They had potato heads. Yeah, never mind. Ethan.
Thanks, Don. That was really helpful for me. Actually, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back with some more on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
What? Radio.
Oh,
radio.
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Radio. Yep. Happy.
CITR has more friends than ever before. We've partnered with tons of local businesses to bring you great discounts in the communities where you live, work, and play. Maybe Main Street is your main drag. Present your Friends of CITR card at Red Cat Records, Lucky's Comics, Devil May Wear, Thriller, Blim, The Kiss Store, The Wallflower Modern Diner, RX Comics, Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Vinyl Records, Regional Assembly of Text, and Twig and Hottie to receive fabulous discounts. So become a CITR member. get a free friends card, and feel the love.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. What a great day today is. We have a lot of great news here on Radio Free Thinker. Well, unless you're someone who wears a head veil in France.
Well, yeah, you know, just for those people who live in France or are planning to go to France or know someone who's planning to go to France or perhaps know someone who knows someone
hey,
who happened.
I know this guy who lives in the UK. He might go to France. I think his name is Rob.
Yes, Rob. Rob, if you're a woman.
Rob, don't wear a veil.
We've talked before about how there's been laws passed in Belgium, and there's one that's been passed now in France. It's passed another hurdle, that is a full ban on the Islamic veil, burqa, what have you, hijab. There's various names for it. It passed the National Assembly a little while ago with a vote of 335-1. It just, in this past week, passed the Senate by a vote of 246-1, notably with 100 abstentions, which it seems like a third of the people wanted to play it politically safe. Just for those people who don't know, this bill prohibits the wearing in public and to foreign tourists of the hijab. If you do wear it, there's a 150 euro fine, which I think works out to be about $300 or so Canadian dollars for violating. The ban will also penalize up to 30,000 euros and 1 year in prison anyone who requires another to wear the face covering, and that doubles if the person being forced is a minor. The ban is going to go into effect in about 6 months, unless it's overturned by the Constitutional Council of France, so essentially the Supreme Court, Constitutional Court in France.
What I'm wondering is, does veil just mean something that goes over the face, or does this include a head covering of any kind?
It has to cover the face. Okay. So it can be just a veil, as long as it covers there's a certain proportion of the face. Obviously, it covers a burqa and hijab. But I'm not sure if you're just, you know, a southern woman who, you know, wants to wear that old or something.
Isn't there like a proud tradition in France of dressing up in like mass and masquerading around?
It's not a veil, though.
But it's covering the face.
Yeah, no.
It's clearly illegal.
Yeah, well, you see, this is the real thing. You see, the fascists in France have figured a way to deny every France person their right to protest using masks by saying, it's a veil. And like, oh, no, it's a veil. You don't have to worry. It's just going to... But you're right. It's going to affect everyone who wants to wear anything. Halloween, outlawed now in France because you can't hide your face.
Interesting.
Actually, it'd be interesting to see how that works out. And I suspect the way this is sort of going up is that it's going to get to the Constitutional Council in France, and it's going to fail there because, as you say, it's either going to have to be rewritten to be much more specific than it is. And granted, we'll have on our blog site the actual French text. And although I have taken French, I can't really read it that well.
Well, you mentioned it has to pass the French Supreme Court, their equivalent. So does this mean that it's passed every other hurdle in France?
It has to be signed by President Sarkozy, who is very much in favor of this bill. He's used it as one of his campaigning things. So that's only last legal thing that needs to be done, but that's no hurdle at all.
Right.
Have you heard anything about the reasoning behind the lone voters against this law? Have you heard anything about what their reasoning is?
No. Have you?
No. I'm just wondering.
I'm wondering, like, what was the breakdown? Do you know the French right, the French left, who? No? Okay.
I imagine you can't break this down to left or right when there's only one person voting against it.
Well, there's also 100 abstentions, though, right?
People... Yeah. For the Senate. It kind of reminds me to bring up a U.S. political example of when the U.S. passes things and Ron Paul is the only one who votes against it. When you get these hilariously lopsided things where just this one person votes against things.
Yeah. Well, I guess the question is, though, I mean, is the right and left in Europe, in France in particular, all that opposed on this issue? I would suspect they're actually very close.
I think one of the things that's played out, and again, it's kind of disturbing in the one sense, and we've talked about this before, is sort of the wave of xenophobia that's going across Europe in its attempt to deal with an influx of immigration. We were talking before the show about Sweden, which is known as sort of the socialist, sort of lefty part of Europe, has just elected 60% of it of nationalist, like crazy right-wing people were voted in, and the center-right party is going to win yet again. And you know, there's this growing wave of anti-, and it doesn't seem to be strictly right-left. It just seems to be Europe. It's almost nationalism, like what swept Europe in before World War One, right? It's like the left and right united in order to protect the Europe we remember.
Right.
I think there is a lot of ambiguousness around what this law is intended to do. Is this law intended to, I use this term very loosely, liberate Muslim women, or is this law intended to say Muslims aren't welcome here?
So, well, I think it's going to do...
Or both.
Potentially both, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, it... The interesting thing with France is it's had a very bizarre history with immigration, from initially having a society that was very excluding to people who didn't buy into the French way of life, mm-hmm. To the point where they got so fed up of being excluded, they became very culturally nationalistic, very willing to flaunt French social norms. So this is sort of this kind of teeter-totter in France of culture and French culture versus foreign culture. And, of course, like any country, they depend on immigration, because I don't think France has a very high population growth.
France actually has one of the highest in Western Europe.
Really?
It actually is above replacement rate, which is pretty rare. But
that's shocking,
It's not highly above it. It's teetering, like, right around it.
Well, that's interesting, actually. That gives a new light to this. But, I mean, we talked recently about France expelling a whole bunch of Romas from the country and getting just absolutely condemned by the international community, both the UN and Germany, really coming down hard on France. So, I mean, it's a trend that I think we've been noticing for a long time. It's very disturbing to see.
Well, I think another aspect of it, because I just did quickly, thanks to the interweb, a little bit of research, and apparently there were 50 communist members of the National Assembly who walked out. So my resource, which sadly enough was largely Wikinews and that kind of thing, so... Yeah. So it does seem there were a number of abstentions in the National Assembly as well, largely the green left people. And I think the reason why they abstained as a voting against it was the idea that we're not even going to dignify this with a vote. I think that's why there is the one sort of thing, right?
Like,
there's the one
dignify it as in, like, it's so horrible to them?
As in, this is so horrible that, you know, if this was a vote about should we ban women from voting, right? Well, some people would say, well, we shouldn't even have this vote. I'm not even going to dignify that. And I think that was the thing. That's why these numbers seem so stark. Plus, I think there's the other element, which we see a lot now in the United States, where the right has this sort of momentum going on that the left is sort of tucking their tail between their legs and just running for cover. They don't want to fight any war that they know they're going to lose, because they're worried they're going to lose what little ground they do have as it is.
Mm-hmm. And as we've mentioned, I think that this is not so much a right-left divide as it is a cultural point of view in most of Europe that transcends party lines in many cases.
Well, you know, and you can't see that any a greater example of that in the atheist community itself, where you get a significant number of atheists who are promoting this sort of movement, and they're not doing it so much because that they're atheists, but because they feel threatened, their culture feels threatened, what they consider to be secular Europe is being threatened by this immigration of what they see as religious people. But really, again, it's a xenophobia. And then, of course, you've got another, hopefully a majority of the atheist community in Europe who are saying, well, no, this is bad as religion, but the way it's being manifested is coming across as a xenophobic or racist activity. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the great example, there's a big fight going over now with Pat Condell, if anyone has heard of him before, and there's a sort of a flame war going on in the YouTube world between him and people sort of against him, because Pat Condell's gone quite UKIP, you know, British Nationalist Party, and, you know, if they're brown, they're bad. He's still an atheist. He still doesn't like the Pope. But, like, 9 out of 10 of his podcasts say Muslims are evil.
Yeah,
he's not rational enough to be an atheist, darn it.
I used to really like him. When he started his YouTube channel, like, he was a good, decent rationalist, and was arguing against Muslims to the extent that someone like Richard Dawkins would, that some of the stuff they do is bad and it should be looked at on humanist principles, but not that all of those people were bad. And I, Pat Condell has just gone crazy lately.
You know, it's funny, it was brought to my attention the other day that Pat Condell supported a petition by a group that's supported by, well, not supported, is operated by Pat Robertson. And if that doesn't strike me as some sort of weird concoction there, right? It was all based on the ground zero. But again, I mean, part of me says, you know, there's probably some really interesting psychological aspects going on in here, right? Something, you know, maybe his daughter was killed by someone from somewhere, I don't know.
Yeah, sounds like a good movie.
Yeah, could be.
Well, getting back onto the good news, well, sort of, we're happy to report that AIDS, HIV is declining in Africa.
Hooray!
Yay! According to the UN AIDS organization, they said that 22 countries in the world's most affected region have seen a drop in new cases of more than 25%, which is great. There are now 5.2 million people worldwide receiving treatment for HIV/AIDS, which has helped to ensure that 200,000 fewer people died from the virus in 2008 than in 2004. Now, we obviously would assume that technology has advanced, treatment has advanced, but what do you think is maybe one of the big factors that has influenced this?
I'm going to guess and say it's the increase in a Jewish tradition.
Increase in Jewish tradition.
Well, a particular one that deals specifically with males and particularly something that would be sex-related.
There is a little bit of information out there that circumcision may have an impact on HIV transmission, although I'm not quite sure if the evidence is
actually fully... No, the evidence is quite convincing. There's been a lot of research into that area.
Are we talking about evidence that circumcision reduces the rate of AIDS, or evidence that it's a major factor in Africa? Because I think
circumcision in itself inhibits one's ability to catch AIDS.
Yes.
The fact that you have a foreskin sort of provides a breeding ground, or that's the theory behind it, where the AIDS virus or the HIV virus can take hold. So if you have AIDS, it doesn't matter whether you're circumcised or not, you still can give it as equally. But if you're doing someone who has AIDS, then circumcision does help. Actually, I think there's another aspect, and I'm going to go crazy here, guys. I know some of the supposed cures for AIDS and all that was to have sex with virgins and that kind of thing, and that would cure you. And I suspect that that would work for the first couple of years, but of course it's not really a cure, so those people would still be getting AIDS and they would be dying off, so that only those people who are sort of rational would survive. And stop looking at me like that.
No. Until you learn your lesson, no.
I don't think I'm going to dignify that with a response.
You're going to walk out. Yeah. Well, one of the big reasons that HIV has been in decline has been the use of condoms, especially in Africa. Now, this is in contrast to some advice that was given out by the Pope recently suggesting that condoms actually increase the rate of transmission of HIV, which most people thought was kind of on the level of crimes against humanity area. But it turns out that despite the Pope's best efforts, condoms are being used and used quite frequently in places like Africa. And as Don mentioned, there are other new interesting medical advancements like the idea of male circumcision. So it does seem to be making an actual impact here. And we're seeing a decline despite what we would assume is the Pope's influence.
Yes.
I think people are just getting fed up. I think there comes a point where, despite what your religious leader says, the fact that you are ill and or have too many children, you give in to, what is the quote here, tradition is giving space to pragmatism.
I think, too, another aspect that maybe helps with this idea of pragmatism is not everyone who was on the crazy part saying condoms cause AIDS. I believe the former Prime Minister of South Africa came out and said that condoms are bad. And he didn't do this from a religious point of view. It's from some new age sort of medical practice idea. And he came and said, oh, no, we don't want it to happen. And he has sort of fallen to the background because he's been proven to be a little bit nuts on this particular issue.
Right. It should be noted that this decline is mostly limited to South Africa. I think the numbers are actually still quite bad in places like India and Central Asia. But, I mean, considering that Africa was sort of the very bad area for this, it's nice to see that there's a decline in progress. Hopefully this will continue, and hopefully science-based medicine will continue to win out over superstition and fear-mongering. Well, why don't we go to commercial break, come back with more on Radio Free Thinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
State of hip hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
On Radio Free Thinker. So we're talking a bit about the Pope. He recently visited the UK, as we've reported on before. I don't suppose he said anything controversial while he was there.
Well, you know, I'm going to get to that, actually. He had a speech in Holyrood. But props for us is that it was a great thing happened. There was a huge rally, over 20,000 people, 10 to 20,000 people, depending on who you talk to, came out and protested against the Pope. And you say, well, why would you want to protest the Pope above and beyond all the other things that he's done? When he went to Holyrood, he did a particular speech, and I've got a long quote here that will be on our website. But it basically says that, you know, historically Britain and her leaders have stood out against Nazi tyranny, that Nazis tried to eradicate God from society and tried to be bad to people, in particular Jews, who they thought were unfit to live. And then a little later on, he says, as we reflect on the sobering lessons of atheist extremists in the 20th century, we should learn that we need to have God and religion in public life, kind of implying that if you're an atheist now, A, you're an extremist, and two, you want to kill people.
Well, you know, I think there's some truth to what the Pope is saying. I mean, let's face it, if anybody should know who a Nazi is, the guy who was in the Hitler Youth should have a pretty good idea, should he not?
Yeah, you know, he who lives in glass houses or something. You know, it's funny, too, because the main thing I want to talk about is Richard Dawkins' speech, but, you know, as atheists, we could almost never get a break. There was a press coverage by an Andrew Brown, and no, not my friend in Ontario, but a British guy working for The Guardian, that commented on Dawkins' speech, and he said that Dawkins later delivered a speech comparing every Catholic in Britain to Adolf Hitler. Now, of course, they had to amend that because that's not what Dawkins said. Dawkins had said that Hitler was as much a Catholic as Britain's people in Britain were Catholic, and it was sort of like four legs make you a cow, but everything that has four legs isn't necessarily a cow.
Yeah, by that, he only ever meant that they didn't fully follow the Catholic teachings. Most of the so-called British Catholics probably don't completely follow the teachings, nor did Hitler. Yeah. That's basically what he was saying, but it's taken horribly out of context.
Well, and you know, speaking of keeping things in context, Richard Dawkins' speech, which starts off basically by saying, and I'm quoting, "Joseph Ratzenberger is an enemy to humanity." He talks about bigotry, and oh, I love this. This is one of my favorite lines I've ever heard. "He is an enemy of women, barring them from the priesthood as though a penis were an essential tool to pastoral duties." Insert pedophile joke here. He also said that he is an enemy of the poor on the planet, condemning them to inflated families that cannot feed and so keep them in bondage of perpetual poverty, a poverty that sits ill in the obscene riches of the Vatican. Now, we were just talking about AIDS in South Africa, and the main root of that is that contraception is a taboo in the Catholic thing, and that disproportionately affects, A, the poor, because they can't afford the children, and two, people who, for lack of a better word, don't have the sophistication to understand that it's a metaphor, maybe, and that maybe even if the Pope says don't use contraception, you still should because it's in your best interest. And people who tend to be in less developed countries tend to fall into that trap much more. So do you think the Pope is a bigot?
I think he's clearly advocating some pretty bad ideas. I mean, if we just determine who is a bigot by their words and actions, which I think is how we generally define most things, then yeah, I think he is.
Okay, so then there's another line, a couple lines, about sex abuse. And Dawkins says, and again I quote, "He is less concerned with saving the bodies of saving children's bodies than saving priestly souls and the church's image." And this, of course, has to do with the fact that he has been more and more implicated with, at least passively, if not actively, hiding and moving around priests who've been accused of and sometimes convicted of sexual child abuse.
I find that interesting because he actually goes out of his way in The God Delusion to make clear that it's not so much the sexual abuse that's the problem when a child is being taught religion, but the actual ideas that they're getting. So the fact that he's bringing this out now, I find this interesting. Comments?
Well, that goes with the next line that I have here, which goes with both abuse, sexual and not a sexual, where he says, "He is an enemy of children whose body he has allowed to be raped and whose mind he has encouraged to be infected with guilt." Now, the guilt he's referring to here is the idea of original sin, and that you are born a bad person, and the only way not to be a bad person is to worship me, the Pope, via God, or via God, the Pope, right? Mm-hmm. And how this sets in right from the beginning, you know, this mindset that we are horrible, bad, horrible people. Reinforced by the fact that because the church has such restrictive rules on one's bodily functions, mainly sexuality, that when you start exhibiting, you know, natural urges as you're a kid, it's not, oh, this is natural and this whatever. It's like, oh my God, you're weak, you're horrible, go whip yourself in the back room or something like that, you know. And this is why I think, you know, that it becomes a form of child abuse. I'm going to be talking a little later on about Hitler and Stalin or whatever, but one of the things that even if you made claims that they were truly atheists or whatever, they still have this sort of, in their child upbringing, this infection of you know, this is the way things are. So even if they go on later.
Well, I mean, there's another aspect to that. I think you could separate the child abuse from or the pedophilia from the religion to a certain degree. I mean, you'd like to assume that most religions don't require pedophilia to be a religion. It wouldn't matter if the Catholic Church was actually a very nice organization, but if they taught children these things about they're inferior, that they're born sinful, and all the various other forms of sexism that they impart, that's bad enough. When you add on child rape to that, it gets to the extreme level. Of course, you know, child rape is always going to be horrible, bad, and it's not just, you know, you don't have to be a religious person to do it. It's bad whoever does it. And I think that you're just sort of adding insult to injury at that point.
You know, and that's actually very important delineation here that we need to make. That, you know, on the one hand, there are some, and I'm going to say there are some individual priests who did horrible crimes, and the church in general protected these people, mm-hmm. but they weren't actually promoting pedophilia in itself. They were they were protecting themselves from it. So I'm not saying every Catholic has to be a pedophile or anything like that. But at the same time, every Catholic in some degree has to promote the idea of child abuse because they do support this teaching of children of heaven and hell. And I mean, if you think about how hell is taught to little children, that's really horrific. That's right up there with saying, you know, if you tell mommy what I did, I'm going to go take dog and burn him on the barbecue. I mean, you do that to a little kid and you scar him for life. Well, they do that at Sunday school. I mean, it's a very similar sort of thing. And that's why I think any form of religious instruction is a form of child abuse. You know, if you want to teach, get people into your church, whatever, wait until they have the this intellectual machinery to handle it, and then do your proselytizing. I still don't like it, but at least at that point, I could say it's a fair game, right? A little 3-year-old, a little 5-year-old, a little 6-year-old, 10-year-old even, just you're brainwashing them. It's not fair to them.
But they need the unfair playing field in order to get new members.
Well, what was it? I'm probably going to misquote, but give me a child until he, a cardinal or whatever says, give me a child
until he is 7.
And I have him for life, yeah. Right? You know, and I mean, we think about it. I mean, we all grew up in sort of a Christian culture, and we use the term evil all the time. Well, if you're an atheist, really, what does evil mean? It's a nonsense, but you use it because it's been ingrained into you from birth. Moving on, and I'm going to save the big ones for last. So I'm going to go into science denier. Yes, isn't funny. I don't think that's the biggest one. So he says he is an enemy of truth, promoting barefaced lies about condoms, not protecting against AIDS, especially in Africa, which we talked about, obstructing vital stem search research on the grounds not of morality, but on a pre-scientific superstition. That is that we have our souls at the moment of contraception and that in doing so you're killing things. And that the church fosters educational pernicious doctrines, the pernicious doctrine, that evidence is a less reliable basis for belief than faith, tradition, revelation, and authority. Of course, his authority, right? So, I mean, you know, it's the stops intellectual activity. Okay, but let's move on. One thing is he talks about, he says, well, Hitler is an atheist. Everyone labels atheists. Oh, well, you know, Hitler was an atheist. He's a bad thing.
And vegetarian.
Yes.
Unimportant. Sorry.
Don't worry. I'm going to reuse that on my debate later. But Adolf, and I'm quoting again, so if these sound a little weird for me saying it, it's not because I'm saying it, it's Richard Dawkins saying. So in the context of his speech, quote, Adolf Hitler was a Roman Catholic, or at least he was much of a Roman Catholic as 5 million so-called Roman Catholics in the country today. Hitler certainly was not an atheist. In 1933, he claimed that he had stamped out atheism, having banned most of German atheist organization, including the German Freethinkers League. Daniel, your club would be on the hit list there. And took their building for the turned it into the Information Bureau for Church Affairs. He was baptized. He never relinquished his baptism. He actually took, there was an attempt on his life, and he went to a Catholic priest. Catholic priest says, thank God that, you know, you're still alive and everything was good. So, I mean, you know, he was a good Catholic. Even if you want to say it was for political reasons, he was pretty good Catholic.
I have to admit that I find this debate of whether or not Hitler was religious a little bit beside the point. He had a rational faith in other things that were much more terrible than God or the lack of God. You know, he had a rational faith that Jews were out to destroy the German way of life. I mean, I really feel that whether or not Hitler was religious is beside the point.
It of course is, but it's sort of, atheists are almost forced to defend themselves on this point because it's so often used by ignorant people as a way to say atheists have no morals, to point to Hitler.
Yeah,
and it's an easy thing for us to defend against because never did Hitler say anything about how he totally had no belief in anything divine. Like, he was a Catholic, like they said. He at the very least believed in some higher power, even if it wasn't quite perfectly the Christian one. But sure, as an atheist, it annoys me. I don't want to talk about this. I'd rather talk about the horrible things Hitler did rather than whether he was an atheist or not. But at the same time, we don't want to just sit by and let others try and throw bad ad hominem attacks at us.
Very true. And going back to the child abuse thing, I do think there are some things that echo, and why maybe sometimes it is important to point out that he isn't really an atheist, not using the true Scotsman type fallacy here, but I mean, in the sense that, I mean, one, why did he pick on the Jews, right? I mean, sure, they were a target, but there were other targets in society you could have used on, but, you know, the whole idea that they killed Christ, right, which resonated both with Catholics and Protestants, and it was a religion, I mean, it was a good hammer, good nail to hammer,
but,
right?
And I'm not going to say in Hitler's defense, but Hitler's target of the Jews was not religious based, though.
It was
culture. It was like racial based.
Yeah, but without a doubt, the predominant Christian churches in Germany at the time, if not being fully anti-Semitic themselves, did nothing to try and stop it.
Oh no, that's a different point, though. Like, I mean,
so basically, what you could argue is that they helped facilitate what Hitler would do.
And actually, I would think he was taking the modern step for what would be pure religious belief and saying, well, you know, if we are, and this goes with the Aryans now, the other part I wanted to get into, if we are sort of God's chosen people, we are the true and proper, you know, way to go, then we need to protect ourselves. I mean, we talked before the show about how, you know, Christians feel they're persecuted in the United States and all that, right? Well, you know, in order to have that, you have to have a certain sense of separateness, of differentness. Mm-hmm. And in a society that was just, you know, coming to terms with the idea of evolution, becoming, you know, with the idea of advanced technology, to say, well, okay, I have these theological beliefs, and I want to cast them into the terminology of the day, which is where I think, you know, sure, Hitler may have been thinking of genetics, and that when he was thinking of the Jews, but where did that original idea come from? Where was it? Well, scrolled in the back of his head, Sunday school. That's kind of the thing. I mean, it may not have happened that way.
If you look, though, at the Nazi propaganda, it was remarkably religious-free. It was mostly focused on, like, things like economic issues and racial issues and cultural issues. It really wasn't all that religiously motivated. But I see your point. Obviously, there was a culture of anti-Semitism, and in general, I think a culture of indifference towards people who weren't part of the mainstream dominant German culture, which was sort of a Protestant middle-class white people.
Well, and there's also elements of evangelicalism in the sense that they wanted to spread the word. I mean, this is where it gets complicated, because Hitler was Aryan and thought that that was the perfect race, but he thought that those ideals could be promoted in other peoples, which is why, you know, there were Nazi people accepted from Ukraine and from Lithuania who are not genetically Aryan, but they thought, well, you know, there's a bit of it in there that we can use, and if we just promote, you know, if we just made you better. Let's move on to a more longer quote, where atheists are evil. So Dawkins says, okay, even if Hitler had been an atheist, as Stalin most surely was, the other bad guy from the 20th century, how dare Ratzenberg suggest that atheism has Ratzinger. Any connection... Thank you. The Pope has suggested that atheism has any connection whatsoever with the horrific deeds, any more than Hitler and Stalin's non-belief in leprechauns or unicorns, any more than they're sporting a mustache along with Franco and Saddam, who are also not nice people. There's no logical pathway from atheism to wickedness. Now, he goes one step further that I'm not quite comfortable with. I'll say it, but I'm not 100% I agree with him on this one. Unless, that is, you are steeped in the vile obscenity that is at the heart of Catholic theology. Now, I kind of agree that religion helps make you a bad person, but it doesn't automatically make you a bad person. It just provides another excuse to become bad.
Well, I think maybe what he meant by this was that Catholicism, perhaps... Maybe this is an arguable point, which I maybe would agree with, but does do a very good job of creating the sort of generalized other. So, I mean, if atheism wasn't around, if we were all fans of Zeus, for instance, you could substitute whatever the religion that you call when you worship Zeus into atheism, and it would probably still ring true, because Catholicism is just as hostile to atheism as it is to polytheism or whatever.
Well, I think another aspect he was going for this, and it goes with Stalin, because Stalin was definitely an atheist, right? But he started off life in a seminary school. So, I mean, he was steeped in Eastern Orthodox, which is similar to Catholic, sort of ideology. But going back to the whole idea of original sin, right? I mean, if you grew up in a truly atheist society, family, then you would not have this concept of original sin, that you are innately a monster, and that people who are not quote-unquote saved are innately monsters, and that maybe in that sense he does have a point in saying that Catholic-type theology gives you a leg up on being a horrible person, because it sets a precondition for you to see people as monsters right from day one, that there is no innocent person in the world to someone who has that Catholic upbringing.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we take a commercial break, and we'll be back to wrap up on Radio Freethinker.
Are you a UBC student taking first year economics, math, chemistry, or physics?
That stuff is hard.
Are you feeling like you need some tutoring? That's okay, because the AMS offers free and appointment tutoring for students in these subjects.
Whoa! How does it work?
It's on a first-come, first-served basis, and there's no need to sign up. Just show up with your books and your questions.
Whoa! When does it happen?
Monday to Thursday from 3 to 7 at the Sub Pacific Spirit Cafeteria, located beside the Starbucks.
Whoa! A+, here I come.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So, Chloe, what was your closing thought there?
Well, I was wondering if the quote, which is, again, for anyone who missed it, there is no logical pathway from atheism to wickedness unless, that is, you are steeped in the vile obscenity at the heart of Catholic theology. I was wondering, I didn't see Richard Dawkins' speech, but I was wondering if the only way that you would come up with a logical pathway from atheism to wickedness is if you were religious, Catholic, or otherwise. The only way to see a connection between atheism and wickedness would come from religion.
So what you're sort of saying is that in the one sense you could interpret it the way I did the first time, that, you know, you need to be religious in order to become an evil person. And then you're sort of saying the only way to interpret these people as being bad is if you had the religious inclination to begin with. That your interpretation of them as bad people comes from, or the connection between atheism and, you know, which is it? Is it that they're bad people because of religion, or that atheism is bad and they're bad, therefore they're together because of religion?
Or that I think that they're bad because my religion says they're bad.
Yeah, I think that, I was wondering if that's what Dawkins was trying to get at. But you saw the speech, you said, and you think that...
Well, and like I say, Dawkins, you know, the root of all evil. I mean,
right.
his views with regards to religion. And I think I would agree with him to the sense that religion is at the heart of most evil, but I think it's a stretch to say it's the root of all evil, because...
I would agree.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we're kind of wrapping up here on Radio Freethinker. Why don't we go to our skeptical highlights? We have some good ones this episode, don't we?
Yeah, well, you know, I discovered this one, sadly, I guess, on the Georgia Strait, because we sometimes have a love-hate relationship with that particular...
We love to hate it?
Yes. So there's a talk going on called Criticize Israel, Go to Jail. It's by an author named Michael Kiefer, who, when I did doing research into this, is one of the people who's, a 9/11er kind of, or at least he was back in the old days, and he thought the 2004 election was a rigged job and all that. But I pushed past my own biases to say, well, okay, just because he's wrong on some things, maybe he's got something here. And he wrote a book called Atheism, Real and Imaginary, which discusses...
Anti-Semitism.
Anti-Semitism. Did I say atheism? Whoops. Anti-Semitism, Real or Imaginary, discusses the threat to free speech posed by an informal coalition of MPs working to expand the definition of anti-Semitism to make it illegal to criticize Israel. Now, the informal coalition he's talking about is the Canadian Parliamentary Coalition to Combat Anti-Semitism. Now, this came up in slightly in our speech when we were talking about Libby Davies and how she says there's a certain amount of fear on Capitol Hill, on Parliament Hill, with regards to this. In the face of mounting international pressure on Israel to end the occupation and to respect Palestinian rights, and there's been a huge debate about this, pro-Israeli organizations are attempting to brand any criticism of Israeli policies as the new anti-Semitism. And basically, in a way to counter this criticism of Israeli occupation of the territories. And it seems that it's getting some ground, at least on Parliament Hill, with this particular group. I found one thing interesting is that the Harper government, one, is a very strong supporter of Israel, which is neutral one way or the other. But this particular group is sponsoring a convention, for lack of a better word, that's got $450,000 grant from a new group in multicultural society that so far I've tried to track down if this group has sponsored anything else, right? It says you can get funding for here, but the only thing it seems to have sponsored so far is this one particular group. Now, you can be open about the topic, but it seems to be an interesting speech. Now, having said that, where is it happening, you might be asking me? It's happening at the SFU Harbor Center. That's 515 West Hastings, September 23rd at 7:30 p.m. It's free. So go there, check it out, see how much of it is real and how much of it is woo. Listen to what they have to say. I was listening to a thing the other day about Gwyn Dyer. He did a speech here on campus, and he said some things, and I agree largely with it, but he had some fact points that I wrote down, and I'm checking them out to see, well, is what he say actually match up with evidence? I think this would be a good approach to go to see this guy. You know, he's going to say, well, there's this, and there's this. Make a note of them, and then after you've listened to a speech, go home and do a little due diligence and see, is this guy on the right road or is he off on left field? Mm-hmm. But it struck me as quite interesting because it's something we talked about before. It's something I've had a feel for before. And thoughts?
Well, it sounds interesting. I mean, it sounds potentially like it's going to go into one of these whirlwind conspiracy theories about it's ultimately going to end with, like, you know, Illuminati and Freemasons secretly controlling the world. But I guess if you go in there with your, baloney detection kit primed and ready, you might be able to make some sense of it, but we'll see.
Well, I think one of the things that makes us, like I say, it can be taken to be the world of Illuminati, but if you were the Israeli government, right, you would have a vested interest to try and promote your government's issue. And I think this is kind of where I would look at as this might be something more serious. I mean, we talked before about the censoring of groups trying to participate in the Toronto Pride Festival, right? And there's been Palestinian groups on campus who have exhibited some issues with that. So I don't think it's a huge conspiracy. In fact, I think Israel government would be nuts not to try and promote this kind of thing for their own interests. It's just we should be kind of aware if it is going on and to what degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely interesting to take a look at. We have some other really fantastic events coming up. On September 25th, James Van Prague, self-proclaimed psychic and medium, is coming to Richmond to do a show at River Rock Casino. Now, in a proud tradition of skepticism, CFI will be at this event to encourage critical thinking. We did this previously with Deepak Chopra and John Edward, and we're going to be doing it again with Van Prague. So we're going to be meeting at the Bridgeport Bus Loop, just beneath Bridgeport SkyTrain Station, around 5:45, 6 o'clock. The event starts at 8 p.m., and we'll start handing out flyers around 7 p.m. as the gates open. So we encourage you to get there early so we have time to make any last-minute plans and go over any possible movement issues with regards to River Rock's property. So, very interesting. Check out our page for more information on that. Coming up a little later on, we have a debate sponsored by CFI, and this debate is going to ask the question, is it wrong to eat meat? So this is going to be very fascinating. And the idea here is to examine the evidence behind the claims that vegetarianism is healthier, more ethical, or environmentally friendly. And the debate will feature friend of the show, Dr. Rob Tarswell, who recently debated in the Putting God to the Test earlier this year, and none other than Radio Freethinker co-host, Don McGlenigan.
Who also features on the poster.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes, it's a wonderful poster. And I promise, Rob, I won't be too hard on you. You know, I understand that being a vegetarian, you don't have quite the same energy that I'm going to have to this debate.
You know.
But don't worry. I just want to set the tone right. You know,
this is
going to be a love fest, I'm sure.
And we should point out that Dawn will be taking the side that vegetarianism is not the best option to take.
If that wasn't obvious by what he just said.
Yeah. And Ra will be taking the option that it is. This debate will take place on September 28th at 7 p.m. in room A130 at Langara College. Admission will be $5, $4 for students, and free for CFI members. We encourage you to check it out. You can find more information on our webpage, of course. And I have one final announcement coming up on October 1st. Yes, well, take your time. I will be giving a talk for the New Bright Lights lecture series on skepticism, and we'll have more information online for that later on. So check out for that.
Yes, and a few months ago now, I think, we talked about Google and some possible issues that they had. Google just released something called Google Transparency Report, which you should definitely check out. It's basically a visual way to look at how many requests from governments they've had to either take stuff down or request for data about users. Just a few quick notable things from it. There have been fewer than 10 removal requests in Canada this year so far. Well, January to June this year. Compared to the US, which has had 128 removal requests, which total up to 678 items. Sorry, Don?
Does their reporting, well, to do the joke, does it include reports to remove things from this report?
No. Well, it does tell you that China doesn't allow them to post this. Something about state secrets.
But... And this is strictly government, so if any large corporate, well, small, large, any non-individual who wanted to request stuff being put down, that wouldn't be part of this report either?
No. This report would be absolutely massive, because that happens on YouTube every, like, 2 seconds. But if it goes to court and a court order is put onto them, it'll show up on here. But if they voluntarily agree to do something because, say, a record label wants them to take down a song, no, that does not end up on here. And one last thing, the UBC Freethinkers are going to be at Club Days this Wednesday and Friday. 10 to 6 on Wednesday, 10 to 3 on Friday.
I just wanted to say that I'm really against club days. I mean, seals have a right to live. And why would you want to club them? Or is this some other kind of club thing?
Let's
just walk out.
UBC clubs. come buy a membership. Come talk to us. Come hang out. I'll be alone a lot, so just come say hi.
Poor Daniel.
I know.
Well, let's wrap up here. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian and executive director of CFI Vancouver, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Chloe. Thank you for listening.
And this is Daniel saying come visit me on club days. I heard you laughing. I thought that